Tonight on The Daily Debrief, emotional testimony from the biological father of a college student accused of killing her mother and stepfather, and testimony from a friend may have linked a defendant to a missing murder weapon in the killings of an entire family because of a fight over a webcam model. Plus, a journalist almost shuts down deliberations in the case of a couple accused of abusing their foster daughter to death. Also, the trial of a rap artist facing charges in Sweden. The Daily Debrief recaps the day in court. It's Tuesday, July 30th.
And good evening, everybody. Welcome to The Debrief. Attorneys Jose Nieves and Michael Bachner with me tonight. The trial of rap artist ASAP Rocky has begun in Sweden. American artist is accused of assault, but he says he's not guilty and acted only in self-defense because he believed he was going to be attacked. The prosecution used a series of videos, including one from TMZ, which show the rapper throwing a victim to the ground and punching him. Prosecutors say videos posted online by ASAP Rocky had been edited to remove clips which show his bodyguard starting the fight. Text messages between the rapper and his crew indicated the video had been, quote, cleaned up a bit. That is what has come out thus far in that trial. Testimony surrounds phones, computers, and a lot of other stuff in the trial of a defendant who authorities say tried to cover his tracks in the case of a Florida man accused of killing his family after he stole their money and sent it to a Bulgarian webcam model. 29-year-old Grant Amato, accused of sending the woman $200,000 from his mother Margaret, his father Chad, and his brother Cody so that she would keep talking to him. When his parents intervened and tried to shut down the so-called relationship, prosecutors say he murdered his family and then tried to cash in their life insurance policies. Prosecutors say the webcam woman, known only as Sylvia, was the defendant's obsession. No one knows if Sylvia is even her real name. The state says the defendant shot his family with precision and then moved his brother's body to make it look like the brother was the shooter. One of the defendant's friends testified for the state about the defendant's knowledge of guns.
Probably the most consistent out of all of us. Usually, most frequently, it would be Grant, Cody, and myself that would go. And we used to joke it would just be to see whether Cody and I could have a good enough day to beat Grant or who of us would have the worst day.
And have you had the occasion to see the defendant wear shooting gloves during the times you guys went shooting?
Yes, I have.
Approximately 2 weeks before January 24th, did you own any firearms?
I did. Both.
And did you own a 9mm?
Yes.
Specifically a Jericho IWI 941?
That's correct.
Did the defendant know that you owned firearms 2 weeks prior to January 24th?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did he specifically know about that Jericho 941?
Yes.
How did he know?
Well, he was there the day Jericho purchased it, and he was there as well the day I purchased it from Jericho, and he purchased another gun from Cody at my previous house, and he's been shooting with us on a couple occasions and used it.
So has he actually shot that firearm before in your presence?
Yes.
Did there come a point in time that evening when the defendant was in the area of your room and closet unaccompanied?
There was.
How long can you estimate that the defendant was up in the area of your room?
I would say no more than 10 minutes.
What's more disturbing is that this witness suggested that one of his own guns was stolen and perhaps used to kill the Amato family.
In the end of May, I stopped a full-time position and was taking a little sabbatical, doing contract work. A couple weeks in, I got antsy and started doing some spring cleaning. I went into the closet and was getting rid of some older stuff. And when I picked up the gun boxes, I noticed that one was significantly lighter than it should be. I opened it up and noticed the firearm and one of the two magazines it came with were missing. And I went through and double checked, and there were 94 out of the 100 rounds still in the bag. I checked the whole closet, moved the shelf under it. Didn't see anything lying on the floor. There was four other firearms in the closet. None of my electronics, guitars, cash, nothing else was missing from the house.
And that night, or that afternoon, do you remember what the defendant was wearing?
jeans and a t-shirt and one of his jackets.
Did he always wear jackets or frequently wear jackets?
Pretty regularly. He tended to get cold.
When did you make a report with the police indicating that the firearm was missing?
June. I don't remember the exact date.
So about 6 months later?
Correct.
Why the delay?
I hadn't had a reason to go touch that gun. I have one that I use as a concealed carry. The rest are either one I don't like to shoot, or like the Jericho was kind of one I consider just a range gun. And honestly, I mean, my friend was killed in January with his parents, and I had no reason to touch my guns.
On cross-examination, the defense dug into that point as to why this witness took so long to notice the gun in question was missing.
So a year later, you know that the prosecution doesn't have a firearm in this case, and 30 days before the trial starts, you file a missing gun report.
Correct.
And you've been talking to Jason regularly, right?
I had been talking to Jason, yes, sir.
And based upon your conversations with Jason, this case has to be resolved before he can do anything with the estate, correct?
Objection.
Sorry?
Have you talked to Jason about the status of the Amato estate?
Objection.
Okay, let's step back here and listen again to some of the defense opening statement. Note here how the defense tries to deflect attention away from the defendant's knowledge of weapons.
Now, Mr. Amato is not guilty. Mr. Amato had no firearm with which to commit these murders because he had sold all of his guns and had no access to any other guns that may have been in the residence. The evidence will show that Mr. Amato is no professional shooter and has no training whatsoever in using a pistol. This is important because he would be incapable of committing these murders all at this time, with this frequency, in this short amount of time, without such training. The evidence will show that when police entered the Amato home on January 25th of 2019, they found a nefarious combination of drugs, guns, and ammunition. The evidence will show the police also found several rifles locked in the closet, along with cans and cans of ammunition. Furthermore, the evidence will show that a Glock pistol was found in a holster, as the state had described earlier, on Chad Amato's body, and Cody Smith & Wesson 9mm that he carried with him was found next to Cody's body.
With me tonight are attorneys Jose Nieves and Michael Bochner. So, Jose, let me ask you, I dug all the way back into the openings there because it seems to me that what the defense is trying to do is disingenuous here. They're trying to say, oh, he sold his guns. He didn't have access to guns. Wait a minute. You know, if you're trying to get up there and say that your client, oh, he has no training and everything, and then there are pictures showing up with all of these poses with the defendant and guns, and you have images at the shooting range, like this one of target practice with the family. I mean, does this jive? Does the defense theory jive with the reality of these pictures?
I don't think so. And I think the prosecution is going to have a field day breaking that apart. I mean, with the pictures and on top of that, the family was very much, you know, involved in gun use and recreational gun activities and stuff like that. And for him to suggest that this person had to have special training to use a gun to kill a person is just really, I think, you know, a lack of understanding of the crime and the use of a firearm.
Michael Bochner, in lay terms, when I see pictures like that at the shooting range, I'm thinking there is training. It might not have been in a formal setting, but again, usually I like to give the defense the theory of the doubt, the benefit of the doubt. I like to hold the state to the burden. Of course, I like to do that. People who watch the program watch me do that. In this case, though, do you think the defense stretched that too far?
Well, it's remarkable to me because Florida is an open discovery state, so they knew what the prosecution's proof was going to be before he made that opening statement. So he had to have seen those pictures, he had to have known what the evidence is going to be, and he still made an argument, which if I'm a juror, I am thinking to myself, I don't get that. We all know that he went to a range, and we all know a buddy said that he's a pretty good shot. What's that all about? And when a defense lawyer loses credibility with the jury, that's bad for his client.
That's exactly where I was going with this. Jose, you're the former prosecutor here. So I know that you said that they would have a field day with this, but if I'm on the jury, I'm really now struggling to give the defense the credit that perhaps it deserves, considering the prosecution has the burden.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're opening like that and then all this evidence is going to come out of how he's used firearms before, you know, what's your closing going to be? I mean, really, how are you going to convince the jury of anything that you're saying if it's not tied to real facts, it's not tied to real evidence? And it looks like, you know, from what I've seen, that the prosecution has the winning hand in this case.
Michael, very quickly here, it looks to me like the defense may stick with the theory that the dead brother did it and then somehow shot himself, because that's one of the theories floating out here. The state has discredited that theory from very early on, though.
Well, sometimes if you need a theory, you look for facts that may support that theory. And a lot of defense attorneys go with the proposition, I'm not getting an acquittal, but maybe I'll get a hung jury. You just need one. So exactly. You throw something out.
Okay, gentlemen, we'll be back with you at the end of the broadcast here. A jury deliberating, meanwhile, the fate of a Georgia husband and wife accused of murdering their 2-year-old foster child. Joseph and Jennifer Rosenbaum face different degrees of murder and other charges over the death of Layla Marie Daniel. The defendant said the little girl died after accidentally choking on a piece of chicken and that she was further injured during CPR. The state said Layla likely died after a seizure, which was probably triggered by abuse. An issue occurred today when a local journalist from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution apparently approached the jury on lunch to see how long deliberations might take. Obviously, that is a very bad thing to do, and the judge issued this reprimand.
I'm going to start by saying that you are not to have any contact with members of the jury. Not friendly, regardless, not how is it going. Not that would listen to any sort of feedback from them to you about the nature of this case or anything. Do you understand that?
Yes, sir.
We've been trying this case for our fourth week. And what we don't need is members of the press putting themselves in a position where they're causing us trouble. There's a motion for mistrial that's been made by the defense.
This reporter stated that the jurors didn't respond to her. And I think we ought to, at the very least, inquire into that. Because if the juror is responding to her substantively and not just, I can't talk to you, then there is grounds for mistrial.
All right. I suppose that there is a need to follow up. Was anything of any substance about the nature of this case said to you?
No, sir.
Anything else? Motion for mistrial is denied.
That's how it ended, and deliberations are continuing. And still ahead tonight, here on The Debrief, the case of a Florida college student accused of murder. The defendant's own brother testifies about the conversation where the defendant confessed to killing their mother and stepfather. But does the law protect her? That question in just a moment. Dramatic testimony now from the brother of a Florida woman who says voices in her head led her to kill her mother and stepfather. Nicole Nachman is raising an insanity defense involving schizophrenia. She's also raising battered child syndrome as self-defense, saying she was beaten and finally snapped back. Nachman confessed that she drove home from Florida State University, shot both of the victims, and then drove back to college. Bennett's brother testified that he learned of the shooting from his uncle. And then he described his first conversation with his sister, the defendant, which basically amounts to a confession.
You know, I started off with the normal chit-chat. You know, love you, we'll see you soon. And then she just was quiet for a second. And then she said, I'm going to miss you, Joey.
Just like that, just very matter-of-fact, yep. I'm going to miss you, Joey?
Yep.
All right. What did you think when you heard her say that?
I didn't know what she meant the first time she said it. And I don't think I made sense of it just yet. And I said, what? You know, something like, say that again or what? She's like, I'm just going to miss you. And I said, what do you mean? And then at this point, saying it out loud sounds weird, but I was thinking maybe she was thinking of hurting herself because her mom's gone. So, but I didn't want to put words in her mouth. And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, I want to say I said, are you thinking you're hurting yourself now at this point? And she said, no, I don't think I'd do that. And I said, so what do you mean by that? And then she got quiet again. And then she says, I shot him. I said, you did what? Like, I shot Mom and Bob. I said, and I remember leaning forward. I remember leaning forward on the couch and saying it again. It's like, what do you mean you shot Mom and Bob? It's like, why'd you do that? Or something to that effect. And she just started crying really bad and talking really fast.
The sister admits to committing the shooting, of course. Now, the legal question is whether the shooting is excusable, that's legal insanity, or justifiable, that's self-defense. The brother continued with this.
Eventually, she got to the point where she was explaining that ever since she got back from London, her school trip, that she's had uncontrollable screaming in her head, and like a high-pitched screaming, and that it was affecting her sleep, and she was having nightmares from it. And then I tried to calm her down some more, and then she said, if I had only gotten the good news phone call about the dorms earlier, if I only got the good news phone call about the dorms earlier. And then she said something that I remember was, I'm sorry I had to do it, but I'm not sorry that I did it, but I'm sorry I had to do it. And then she was, more crying and things like that. And then I remember thinking to myself, well, I don't know what to do now, so I'm going to call my family and have them help me think correctly about this.
What did she tell you specifically about shooting Bob?
Yeah, she said, and then she went into like a whisper, and she was like, I didn't think I could do it, Joey. I didn't think I could do it, but I shot Bob. I didn't think I could do it. And it was just weird because it was in a whisper and almost sounded like she was proud of herself.
The brother went on to say a series of motivational posters apparently encouraged the defendant to, quote, finish the job by shooting the mother.
She described after she shot Bob that a lot of the screaming went away in her head. It didn't go away all the way, but it went away a lot. And then she described she went up to her dorm and she was hanging out in the dorm. And she kept seeing the signs in her hallway and her stairwell saying, your dreams are almost realized, keep going, things like that, like motivational posters. And she took that as a sign from God to go back and finish a job. So then she told me she went back to Tampa and she waited in the house overnight for my mom. And then when my mom got home, she said that she got cold feet the last second. She wanted to get out of the house. So she mistimed it. She jumped out of the window to not meet my mom. So my mom was walking in the house, and she wanted to jump out the window and just time it to where she would miss her. And she mistimed it and ran into my mom. And she said, my mom said, Nikki, what the f*** are you doing here? And she said she blacked out, and somehow she knows she did it.
On cross-examination, the defendant's brother said the defendant went from an outgoing child to a withdrawn young adult and illustrated a somewhat tense relationship between the defendant and the mother she admits she shot and killed. Now, defense has the case. One witness who testified was the defendant's biological father, who lost custody of the defendant decades ago.
The last time she was in with me in our home, that was October 7th of 1996.
So in October of 96 was the last time you were able to basically have her in your home.
And care for her, yes ma'am.
And she would have been about two then, two and a half?
Going on three, yeah.
And then the last time you physically laid eyes on her as a child was in 1998 when she was about four.
Four and a half, September 28th, ma'am, down here at the supervised visitation program.
Did you ever give up on attempting to have a relationship with your daughter?
I never gave up one day. Not one day.
The defendant's biological father said he reached back out to his daughter after 20 years after the arrest.
After her arrest, did you immediately attempt to reunite and have contact with her in August of 2015?
Yes, ma'am. I came here. I went over to the jail. And I got information about mailing postcards. And
so you immediately tried to reinitiate contact.
I sent her postcards every day. I still do. And I put money into a phone account and canteen for her.
And have you maintained regular contact with Nicole since her arrest and since this case has been pending?
Almost every day I sent her a postcard telling her I love her. We've had audio-visual contact through, and I for many months I drove over to Tampa to see her through the TV or the, I've had holiday contact, and also with her family in Cincinnati. All her family in Cincinnati, we've had regular contact with her.
Your family,
the paternal family of Nicole's in Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky.
Returning now, our attorneys Michael Bachner and Jose Nieves. So, Jose, do we see evidence here of a mental health defense or not? Is it a good defense? Is it a weak defense?
You know, I think you do see some evidence of a mental health defect. You have some evidence of, information that she was acting erratically. She was withdrawn. She was isolated throughout her life by her mother. Her mother was very overbearing. However, I just don't think that we have enough here to show that she had a complete disconnect with reality, to show that she failed to observe, to appreciate the gravity of her actions when she killed the stepfather, and then to show that she felt like she had to kill her mother in self-defense.
Exactly, I agree with you, and whenever I listen to defenses like this, I'm listening for the key words that suggest premeditation and an understanding of right and wrong. And when you have things like whispering to the brother that, I finally did it, and he said as if she was bragging, that doesn't sound like a mental health defense to me, at least not a successful one. So, Michael Bachner, I'll ask you, proper here for some kind of self-defense? Because I think that's an even more wild theory. I don't know about you.
I don't see any self-defense. And candidly, the statement that she made to the brother, in my opinion, reflects also that she knew the difference between right and wrong, where she's saying, I can't believe I was able to do it. That means that there was something telling her it was wrong to do it.
I'm seeing
here. And
she
overcame that.
I'm seeing here premeditation, possibly. There's at least some evidence of it. And I'm seeing here consciousness of guilt, likely, because she said to the brother, I'm going to miss you. In other words, I'm probably not going to see you again but through this plate glass and with the phone in my hand, correct?
Right. And she's already setting it up in her mind what the future holds for her and her family. And it doesn't bode well for her. We've been looking at the trial for some time. And we've seen a lot of motive, but we haven't seen a lot of mental defect. And I think that's where it's going to fall short. And it's unfortunate because there is something there, but it's nearly not enough.
Is it a reasonable enough excuse?
It's nearly not enough to justify it.
Attorneys Jose Nieves and Michael Bachner, appreciate the insight tonight here on The Debrief. We are out of time. The Debrief back at 5 o'clock tomorrow. Live trial coverage picks up at 9 a.m. Have a good night. We'll see you tomorrow.